So good morning. So as Jen said, one of the ways that we've been working to build a stronger field of public health law research is to work on the methods that are used in doing the research. And Alex Wagenaar and I are editing a collection of individual essays covering the gamut of research methods issues, which will be published by Wiley Josie Bass. Actually, I think the pub date will be in 2013. However, the good news is the chapters are being published as they're completed on our website at PHLR, and already four chapters are available, including key chapters on how to measure law for evaluation research, and a chapter on quasi-experimental designs or studying law without randomization, but with strong basis for causal inference that Alex has written a wonderful chapter. And we're starting to fill in what we call our chapters on the mechanisms of legal effect, which is what I'm going to describe in the first talk today, the general idea of breaking down the study of law into smaller pieces, both for conceptual clarity and for research feasibility. All right, so rituals completed. We were to have three presentations, aside from mine, one a sort of overview of what we're talking about when we talk about mechanisms of legal effect and why it matters, and a couple of examples. And then several instances where someone from another discipline, other than law, shows how law and legal behavior and the work of legal institutions can be integrated into general behavioral theory. Or how law can be, compliance or legal behavior can be described. Frank would have been a really important one to have because, of course, economics and law have been tightly tied for now, almost 40 years. This is a very strong law and economics movement that uses economics and has developed a number of tools and conceptual frames for looking at law through the lens of the science of economics. But although that's probably gotten the most attention and the most money over the years in legal circles, there are lots of other really good ways to use social science to look at law. So I'll be talking about taking one approach, or talking about one aspect of the problem, in looking at the work on procedural justice, which explains why people obey the law. So it's a social psychological theory that was developed to explain compliance with law. So it looks like psychology, but it's about law. Sort of one generic approach is you have a body of research that actually focuses, has long focused and has been validated in explaining what happens between the passage of a law and behavior. Brian will take sort of the other piece of the story we're trying to tell, and that's when you take a general behavioral theory that is widely used to explain behavior, to theorize, create hypotheses and test the drivers of behavior, but you place legal law-related behavior within that larger framework, which is also quite feasible. Either one gets you a long way towards a richer understanding of how law works and creates a number of opportunities for learning and learning both in terms of how the law works and how we can work with the law that I'm going to talk about in this introductory presentation. So this is the basic problem. Ultimately, research on law and health is about how law influences health. Right? That's what we care about. Now, at PHLR, we sort of have a very simple causal diagram that tries to fill in, how that happens. Most obviously, law leads to a change in behavior, people putting on safety belts instead of not putting on safety belts, and that, because putting on a safety belt is protective, leads to an improvement in population health. Or law may change environments. It may prohibit the dumping of really nasty stuff into the air or water, leading, without changes in behavior, to improvements in population health. Or you have some kind of interrelationship. We pass laws that essentially stigmatize smoking. Or we make a great effort to, in some sense we restrict smoking to a certain corner of the building or a certain corner outside the building, And one of the things we're doing, of course, is telling people they cannot behave as they used to, they can't smoke where they used to, but more profoundly what we're doing is changing the normative environment. We're making smoking something that is, you know, sort of creepy to do. And so we're really changing the social environment, so you have a multiple effect there. And of course, what you also have to throw in to really catch the whole picture is that laws don't just happen and then people change. Laws are implemented, and implementation or non-implementation, good implementation versus poor implementation, they can also have a big effect as a mediator on what happens in population health. And actually, sometimes you don't even have really a law. You just have the practices of legal agents, police officers doing things that are not necessarily what's contemplated in the law, but nonetheless can have an impact on health outcomes. So sometimes legal practices are really the input. Well, you know, traditionally in research on the effects of law on health, that part between the law and the health outcome has been sort of a black box, or at least here, like a dark gray box. Not that it's never studied, but I think it's fair to say it's rarely studied with the precision and rigor that's possible. And sometimes that really hasn't mattered. I mean, if you take, for example, a large-scale panel study of many, many states implementing primary seatbelt or safety belt laws, in a quasi-experimental design with many points of comparison over a long period of time. Well, implementation to some degree may wash out under those circumstances. Differences in how state A versus state B implement a primary or secondary law. You're still going to get a pretty good result that reliably will tell you that primary seatbelt laws are working better than secondary seatbelt laws. But you don't get everything you could get. There are a lot of benefits to opening the box. I mean, first of all, even when you're contemplating evaluating a law, in fact, even frankly, when you're contemplating deciding to support a law or advocate a law in the absence of complete information, thinking through the theories of how law works can be very beneficial in a number of ways. I mean, for one thing, of course, it can tell you about different kind of effects to measure, where to look for data that would be indicative, that would tend to validate or falsify a hypothesis that law was having an effect, and also what sort of unintended and intended consequences to look for. So with my students in a law school class, when we're talking about policy, I'll often have them go through a logic model. In dealing with that, someone proposes we should pass a law to do X or Y, because you know you may find that there somewhere in a well-defined theory of how law works, you'll find a big gap in the particular case that you're talking about. Putting it sort of into epidemiological terms, when you just have an association between a law and an outcome, you know, you've come some way in the traditional analysis of causation and epidemiology to thinking that there might be support for an inference of causation. But it's also really important, aside from going through the usual criteria examining that association, if you can identify the mechanism through which law might have had that effect. If you can show a pathway of this happening, this happening, this happening, compliance, which you often can with sociolegal theory or other behavioral theory applying law, then that's going to, of course, tend to support your inference of causation. And of course, by contrast, if you see a big hole, something that just isn't likely to be happening or which you can show isn't happening, between those two points, then it may be that your correlation is just an accident. And finally, in very practical terms, because remember, we're trying to take this research on law, which is, like all research, a little bit late, a little bit slow, and get as much value as we can for practice. And one way is that, you know, say you do have pretty good association between law and the effect on health, and you can see how it's working, that also means potentially you can see how it could work better. You know, if we understand where in the implementation stage we might be losing degrees of compliance, losing degrees of effectiveness, then that gives us something to tell people, not only, well, it's nice to have that law pass it some more, which is really not real advice. It's how can we change the law or the enforcement practices so that we get more compliance and a bigger health effect out of that work. So let me give you an example of this kind of integration issue. So I did a study that was asking a very hard question, whether laws that criminalize exposure of others to HIV are effective in promoting the public health goal of less risky sex. So in other words, if we make a law that tells a person with HIV that person cannot have sex with another person without disclosing HIV status because the laws are all over the place, practicing safer sex. So we looked in this case at sort of just initially thinking this through. Well, there are sort of three traditional ways you look at the way a criminal law has an effect on anything. One is incapacitation. So you just take the people who are doing the bad thing and put them in a jail cell where they can't do that thing anymore. Another is deterrence, which is itself a fairly complicated theory, but basically comes down to people are afraid of being punished if they do the thing, so they don't do it. And the third is what you might call normative theories of compliance, which I'll be talking about when I become Tom Tyler. But basically the idea that people either think the behavior is wrong and therefore don't want to do it, and the law may be signaling that belief, or they just believe that law should usually be obeyed, regardless of whether you agree with it or not. Any one of those alone or in combination could lead someone to obey that law and produce safer behavior. Well, we knew from some prior research when we started to study that incapacitation wasn't likely to be having an effect. You know, at that time, I think there were 50 or 60,000 new cases a year of HIV, and there were about 30 prosecutions that led to, and not all of those even led to conviction or imprisonment. So it was unlikely that, you know, the jailing of 20 or 25 people each year was going to have much of an effect of HIV incidents via incapacitation. So again, an example of where you can, if you think about the problem in its pieces, you can know a lot from what you already know, even before you get to focusing on what you're going to collect new data on. As for deterrence, well, I mean, you know, again, there's two pieces to good theory and well-established, well-developed theory. One is that you have a question you can test, and the other is that you have tools that you can draw upon, well-developed tools for doing the testing. So in this case, there's a couple of ways you can slice deterrence. You know, in some branches of deterrence theory, a big piece is thought of as the likelihood that you'll be detected. So you can ask, as we did, questions that add up to a measure of how likely people feel that when they do something wrong, they will get caught. And the more likely you feel that you're going to get caught when you do something wrong, the more likely you are to be deterred from doing that, according to this theory. There's also a way of thinking about deterrence which has to do with the magnitude of the consequences. So these two are not entirely unrelated, as you can see. But so again, we can ask people, this generates well-trodden kinds of approaches to quiz people on their feelings about potential sanctions should they be caught. Now, So one way to think about this is we just took a question of criminal law and we used traditional tools for theorizing and measuring the effect of criminal law in our study. But we were having a little more fun than that because we were interested in sort of taking that other step that's possible, and that is, well, you know, it's a little odd to think about why people have sex as a question of criminal behavior. That's a question of human behavior. Let's, you know, turn to theories about human behavior and see if we can find a way to put law, you know, more explicitly into those frameworks. So we'll ask essentially the question of law and compliance as a question of human behavior. So, you know, in the theory of planned behavior, which is a, you know, a well-regarded and at that time often used theory that used a very carefully thought-out theoretical process to try and identify, to predict behavior based on people's professed behavioral intentions. We thought, well, let's see if we can use that to help us with our research, because after all, the way we were doing this research was a survey of people about the behavior they reported already having done, but, you know, ultimately with the goal of trying to understand what will they actually do in the future based on what they tell us. And of course, that's what's neat about this theory, because it purports to be able to give you a pretty reliable prediction, not based on observing the behavior itself, but on understanding what the behavioral intention is. So that was a nice body of knowledge for us to draw upon. And so what we essentially did was integrate some of those previous criminal theories that I talked about into a theory of planned behavior. So in what we called don't worry too much about the labels, but we had we took the idea of deterrence and called it sort of the fear hypothesis. Now, the perceived or actual control is a way that it's a construct in the theory of planned behavior that looks at, you know, your sense that you could actually do the thing that you want to do. And so we conceptualized deterrence as a limit on that. Because if you think that if you try and do it, you're going to get caught, that was sort of a limit on your perceived ability to do it. So we plugged our deterrence questions into the model along that line between laws and perceived or actual control. And then we divided up, this is certainly a fine line, even semantically, a couple of more normative questions of enforcement of compliance with law into guilt and shame hypotheses. The guilt hypothesis was mainly you would tend to feel guilty for doing it if you did this thing, because it violates your own norms and you just would feel bad. So in other words, that we plugged that into the notion of the idea that the person's attitude in this theory of planned behavior, a person's attitude towards behavior, is also predictive of their behavioral intention. If you have a positive attitude towards the behavior, you're probably more likely to do it. If you have a negative attitude, you're less likely to do it. And so a sense that this was a bad thing to do, that you'd feel guilty about, that would tend to suppress your positive attitude score. And then finally, we took the other piece of normative sort of compliance, shame, which we were thinking of in terms of not so much your own feelings about the activity, but how you would feel if other people that you respect found out that you'd done it, right? In which case you would be red in the face, even if you sort of didn't really think it was bad, the social pressure of others' disapproval, and that again plugged into a basic construct of the theory of planned behavior, the notion of subjective norms. Throw a little law enforcement into the mix, which certainly mediates something like shame particularly. and you have a way of using a pretty well-established and precise and rigorous theoretical construct in the behavioral sciences to look at a legal question in a pretty focused way. It then also generates, gives you a chance to use the basic tools that have been developed in that theory. So the way subjective norms tend to get asked about in the theory of planned behavior is you ask people to imagine reference individuals that they respect and how they predict those people would feel if I did this thing. And if, you know, the answer is, well, I would be terribly ashamed and embarrassed because people would, you know, basically think it was terrible, then that's going to indicate that subjective norms are sort of predictive of not intending to engage in that behavior. So in the end, this study, we'd already gone in with data that suggested incapacitation wasn't making a difference. We found that that belief that it's wrong to do it, the normative ones, the ones associated with whether you feel guilty or ashamed, those were predictive of people's statements, actually of their, with looking at their actual past self-reported behavior. Likewise, people who were more afraid of punishment were much less likely to report past unsafe sex without disclosure or use of a condom. The interesting thing about the design, because remember this was a survey of people's self-reported behavior, wasn't really looking at law on one side and behavior on the other. It was focusing on the mechanisms. And we felt pretty confident in that this is a null hypothesis approach, but we felt pretty confident in ruling out the law as a cause of any of this because there was no connection between knowledge of what the law was and these beliefs. So as people who didn't want to get in trouble did what they thought was the good thing. People who thought something was good did that thing, but there was strong connections between those beliefs and the behavior, but there was no connection anywhere between those beliefs and the law. Neither objectively, they lived in a state that had a law that was consistent with those views or not, or subjectively, which is that they knew what the law was. So, you know, the conclusion I drew from this was essentially that the safest thing we could say about these laws, and again, they're pretty hard to study, but the safest thing we could say was that there's a very strong view out in the world that people who have HIV should protect other people from HIV. This view is in fact shared very strongly by people who have HIV. And having that belief is very strongly correlated with what people say about their sexual behavior. It happens to be the same message that these laws send, but there doesn't seem to be any connection between these laws and people's having those views. This is one of those classic cases where the norm was first, then came the law. And so it made it seem, you know, considerably less likely that the law was the driver of these beliefs or was necessary to promoting these beliefs. And we got that all from using theory to make sure we asked the right questions about how this law might be leading from something on the books to compliance on the streets. So this is just a sampling, and you're going to hear more about other ways from Brian, and I'll do the Tom Tyler version too of how you can use law. But there's even more deeper forms that we're not even covering today. For example, there's a 40-year, almost 50-year tradition of what we call law and society research that sort of turns things around, and instead of thinking law and so much of law in terms of a discrete item that changes behavior, it's all about how we all kind of create what law means and how our constructions of legal meaning are shaping our expectations about the world as well as our specific behaviors. And although I won't have a chance to talk about it today, we're using that theory, Jen and I, in a study of health departments and how they use law. And we're conceptualizing that in terms of people's in what we call legal consciousness. Their whole sense of what law can and cannot do. It's not just a question of specific knowledge of a particular legal authority. It's really whether you think of law as something that, you know, is a positive force, something that you can wield, something that is effective, or whether you think of law as a sort of very dangerous external force that you want to avoid at all costs. So again, that's another way in which you can get very rich thinking about how law works, not by reinventing the wheel, but by just go finding the wheel in the wheel store, which is as close as your nearest library, and using well-established methods and theories. So, you know, the conclusion is that both theories about how law works and general behavioral theory are right there waiting for us and can be used to open up the black box of legal effect in studies of how law affects health and health behavior. Developing theoretical frameworks and validated measurement tools for this still should be done and is still a priority for the field. And of course, my biggest message of all, and we really have to get this across to the non-lawyers we work with, the legally conscious people we work with, is that law is not a special case. It is just another set of behaviors and institutions and norms that influence behavior, same as we study in other focus areas of behavioral research. And the goal is not to now have a special room just for the law and get more people to come into it. The truth is we all want to take a little bit of law into all those other rooms. We want to integrate law into general work. You can get the paper and read it yourself. It's available on the web, and you can just Google criminal laws influence HIV risk, and I'm sure you'll get to it. Everything in the world relevant to PHOR is available at our website. Thank you.